A New Year's Eve update from Grey History Headquarters, our French Revolution tour is officially confirmed. The response has been fantastic, and the tour is definitely going ahead. If you want to join us in Paris and the Loire in May 2026, now's the time. Fewer than 10 places remain, and early bird pricing ends on the 7th of January, 2026. Reserve your spot today at greyhistory.com/tour. Grey History's French Revolution Tour is now live for May 2026. Over 8 days, we'll experience the revolution where it actually happened, from Versailles to the streets of Paris to far beyond the capital. If you want to come, book your space at greyhistory.com/tour right now. I look forward to meeting you in revolutionary France. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Grey History. Episode 105, The Republican Calendar with historian Matt Shaw. In the 18th century, time was far from settled. From religious festivities to seasonal rhythms, the concept of time was surprisingly fluid in the early modern era. Today, historian Matthew Shaw joins us in this special members-only interview. The leading expert on the Republican calendar, Shaw explores how fragmented concepts of time encouraged this controversial reform. We also discuss the various motivations of its proponents and unpack the confusion and politics which accompanied its chaotic implementation and collapse. From Thermidor to Napoleon, from the Day of Wax to the Directory, get ready for an episode that bends time itself. But before we explore the Republic's attempts to redefine the year, a huge thank you to the entire Grey History community. Irrelevant of how you measure time, this podcast would not have lasted without your amazing generosity. So, as always, thank you for your support of the show. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out or share them in the community Discord. Finally, a warm welcome to our newest members of the Grey History community. This includes the new Virtuous Citizens, Laszlo, Leif, and Lois, as well as the new True Revolutionaries, Jim and Christopher. Furthermore, I would like to thank Justin, Peter, and Mark for increasing their support and becoming True Revolutionaries. Now, on the topic of increased support, thank you so much to Roby for their extra generosity and becoming an amazing champion of the people. Lastly, the names of heroes ring through the ages, and so a special salute to the Pantheon of Greats, Brian, Jeff, Kevin R, Scott, Howard, Hilberto, Kevin S, and Griff. Thank you to every member of this incredible community. Matt Shaw, welcome to Grey History.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks for inviting me, William.
No, thank you for coming. I am thrilled to have this opportunity because while the Republican calendar is one of the most memorable inventions of the revolutionary era, I also think it's perhaps one of the most misunderstood. I think people make a lot of assumptions relating to the calendar's motivations, to its purpose, to its success, to its implementation. And so I'm really excited to get into the details here and perhaps debunk a few myths as well. Now, it caught me by surprise when I was reading your research was just how fluid the concept of time was in the 18th century. Today, time feels relatively fixed. It feels like a relatively universal concept. Yes, different countries may still use different dating systems, but broadly speaking, most of the world has adopted a standardized way of measuring time. And because of that, attempts to redefine time, I think it comes across to us in the 21st century as something rather odd or even something foolish, perhaps. But What caught me off guard was the extent to which time as a concept wasn't settled in the 18th century and just how much variation there was across Europe and within individual nations as well. So to start us off, I think it would be helpful if you could paint a picture of how Europeans, and especially the French, understood time on the eve of the revolution and why something like changing the calendar, well, it was perceived that the calendar could change and could be reformed rather than something that was fixed.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting way of setting things up. And I think you're right. I think the 18th century, and there we are using sort of some modern periodization, trying to label a point in time with certain characteristics when there was, you know, a huge amount of variation. But that period was an interesting point in timekeeping and experiences of time and so on. And probably links to a bunch of other processes. This is a time when nations are being defined and industries developing and education is changing and various things evolved in the Enlightenment, or the Enlightenment's changed the way people look at the world. So there's a lot going on. And I suppose that was what I was trying to do when I studied the French Republican calendar, situate it within its context. And for us, changing the calendar would seem really quite dramatic. And of course, there were a lot of dramatic things taking place during the revolutionary period. And we shouldn't underestimate its novelty and so on. But you're right, there were a whole range of forms of time, I suppose, from work time, which I suppose is the one that shapes our lives today. But that was very different back then. No 9-to-5, no salary, no offices in the same way. And most people working in the countryside, of course. So you have the religious time as well being hugely important, but uneven, and a big difference between Protestant areas, Catholic areas, Jewish communities, and then Muslim communities elsewhere in Europe as well, and the Orthodox Christian churches having their own calendar, or using an older calendar anyway. For those of us in England, we move through the jump between the Julian calendar and the Gregorian calendar as well, where supposedly people were upset at the loss of 11 days and so on. So you get those sorts of layers of time. And I suppose timekeeping is the other more intimate daily hours of the day. Watches were of military and navigational importance. And they were pretty widespread as well, particularly in urban environments. But most people wouldn't be able to afford a watch. So sundials, the way that time was mapped to the sun rather than the regular beating of the clock, meant that even if people found time to be a natural, unchanging thing, in that it hadn't really changed very much from them, perhaps. It was actually quite a fluid thing. It changed throughout the year, and there were different timekeeping signals to follow, from bells and church services through to maybe the factory clock if they were working in that sort of environment.
Yeah, one of the things that I didn't quite appreciate until I was reading your work was just the variations that something like religion could have on someone's perception of time, even within Christian communities. As you said, the Orthodox largely had their own calendar, but Protestants and Catholics might celebrate different days and handle different days differently. Jewish communities, likewise. You also had environmental factors. And then if you zoom up on a larger national scale, it kind of makes sense that, you know, the Gregorian calendar is named after a pope. There is a religious aspect to this particular way of keeping time that means that for some who have grown up in the Enlightenment, they don't perceive the Gregorian calendar as necessarily a natural invention as much as it is a papal invention. And that kind of ties into something that can be changed. One of the things that you mentioned in your work is also that you start to see more and more kind of state intervention in time regulation around things like fairs and market days and the like. Are you maybe able to elaborate just a little bit on this idea that a national government, a centralized government in particular, could enforce new ways of time, so to speak, and new daily rhythms upon a community from afar?
Yeah, I think that question of central authority and local variation is one of the key ones from this period. And France as a nation is really being built as a nation through the 18th century and is still a kingdom of provinces with their own parlements and laws and duties and so on. And it's quite hard to be sort of sitting in Versailles or wherever and saying, right, this is what's going to happen, and pulling the levers of power. And even in such a powerful, pretty centralized compared to some other state as France, you know, something may not happen at the other end of pulling this lever. So I suppose fairs and markets are a point where this conflict is pretty apparent, and quite a few people have been studying them and how they operate locally. And they're really important local events for trade, for the importance of the town or village. If you can hold a market, it's financially important. It brings with a whole host of other benefits, I suppose, and also laws and things related to the regulation, what time it can meet, whole bunch of questions about public order. You may have a fair that may descend in sort of drunkenness at the end of it. You may not want that, but on the other hand, you do want the financial benefits. And these fairs and markets have grown up over time, and they don't happen sort of randomly. They are quite well regulated. And there is a sense amongst philosophers, economists, the authorities, that too many fairs and markets are a bad thing. It's just very ineffective. You might have competing markets on the same day and so on. So there's a long-standing desire to reform these events. And I suppose you're also getting a longer historical process of the Counter-Reformation and an attempt to impose religious and public authority on the populace. And there are varying views as to what's going on in terms of state control and individuals being succumbing to that. And you might have a sort of Foucauldian view where order is being opposed from the centre, and this whole bunch of discourses, or there may be more pragmatic things, or they may actually say, well, this is something which is trying to be imposed but isn't really happening, and every time you see a law, it just shows the thing they're trying to ban is still really going on. But yeah, so fairs and markets are a point of conflict, I suppose, between local authority and central authority, between individual farmers, between publicans, between them and perhaps religious reformers. But it's also a way of scheduling the year, particularly fairs, which should be big events. People may travel from a long way, bringing their produce with them. But tied into sort of saints' days would be how you marked your contracts, maybe, or your rent would be tied into these events. And so this is something which, when the canon does get reformed, is alighted on as a really important thing to change. A lot of time is spent reforming this aspect of things.
You mentioned there, I mean, to build on that further around motivations and some of the implications of changing the time. So by the time we get to the French Revolution, we already have in place a state starting to regulate time more. We see Britain and Prussia make the leap to the Gregorian calendar, but that is not seen as something that is necessarily natural. As I said before, it's a papal reform in the eyes of some. And when we get to the Republican calendar in 1793, one of the most famous inventions of the revolutionary era, it inevitably is discussed often in the context of de-Christianization, and it's often remembered as an anti-clerical weapon. But your research makes the point that there are other motivations behind this that are far broader, motivations that are political, administrative, ideological, things beyond just related to kind of anti-clerical pursuits. I was wondering if you could maybe outline what some of those motivations were and just how broad these motivations could be beyond the motivations of those that had de-Christianization as a priority.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's really important to distinguish between the origins of the calendar and then how it was implemented over time. And those things often sort of went in different directions, and people involved had different motivations and so on. These things changed over time. I suppose if you look at the people who were involved in the origins of the calendar, they were probably deists rather than strongly Catholic. Nobody particularly involved in it, except somebody who wasn't involved in it but inspired it, Sylvain Maréchal, who had the idea for a reformed calendar, or a calendar of great men before the revolution. And he was definitely anti-clerical and an atheist. But that was unusual. Most people had some sort of religious belief. But you would also want to, within the whole range of revolutionary or republican sentiment, you would want to place the nation above the church and any other sort of form of authority within that power structure and within that sense of rationality, I suppose. So I looked at the origins of the calendar in terms of where did it come from? What were the motivations? And there was sort of two, I suppose, points that caused it to be developed. The firstly was the tradition of dating legal acts from the reign of the monarch. So once the monarch was abolished, you had to decide, oh, we're dating the year, we're in the year of the Republic or whatever. And newspapers and other people started to talk about the first year of liberty and so on. So this sort of symbolic memorializing and reifying the nation and the Republic raises questions about what to do about the calendar and automatically creates its own annual cycle, if nothing else. And within that, you can also map in, I suppose, the particular events of the revolution. People wanted to begin to commemorate certain things, like the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen or something like that. So there was some sense that you needed to do something about the year and how to date that. At the same time, of course, there's a whole host of other reforms. This sense the nation needs to be regenerated. And if you read your classical authors, you realize that if you have a republic, you need to have a very virtuous citizenry. They would need to be educated and brought along into these ways and think like a republican or think like a French citizen. So a whole host of reforms were suggested, education, arts, and so on. People also began to spontaneously, celebrate, have celebrations in the village, change their codes of dress and refer to one another as tu rather than vu and all of those sorts of signifiers of a new sort of order. So you have the sense of regeneration, cultural regeneration. Within the government, there's a committee of public instruction, public education, which looks at all these things and is very good at bringing in artists and other thinkers to help with their reforms. One of the things they know they want to do is reform weights and measures, and that initially is mass, distance, and so on. And there's a practical reason for that. If you want to have an army or navy going somewhere, it's good to have a good way of measuring the world. If you're selling things, then you want to be able to sell things using the same weights and measures rather than the very inefficient way whenever you sell your cotton or whatever, or woolens or paper or grain or wine. From one region to another, firstly, in the old Ancien regime, you'd pay tax, and then you may also have different weights and measures, so it's very hard to know what you're buying and selling. So there's been long-standing sense this needs to be reformed and unified. And so there is this desire to come up with a single system. It makes sense to the revolutionaries to look at the natural world. That's the sort of the basis for harmony and how you understand and approach the world. So it's based on the size of the earth. It ultimately defines the meter. The weights and measures are also then linked to distance. And you have a kilogram being based on the weight of water and so on. Ultimately, you get centigrade and things like that also tied into this metric system. So this is all being worked out, and is the Committee of Public Instruction is taking care of that. And then they receive an instruction from the National Assembly to decide what to do about the start of the year. When do they count their laws from? Is it the 1st of January or the beginning of the meeting of that assembly? Or what's it going to be? So they need to bring the eras into harmony is the request. And it's uncertain what that meant. There wasn't much discussion about it. It implied bringing this whole brave new world into harmony with the other systems that are out there. It could suggest getting rid of the religious calendar, but it seems to be more just looking at the law. When do you count the start of this legal year from? But they realized that they could do much, search more. With this, Charles Jubéron, the person sort of tasked with it, comes up with the idea of a whole new calendar. He'd probably been inspired by Maréchal. He was a poet and playwright, but also came up with a non-religious calendar, which was banned and burnt, censored. But it had things like Newton being commemorated on Christmas Day and things like that. So they realized they could do something different. If you read the Encyclopédie, which of course a lot of them would have done and were aware of these things. Time was something that people saw as a basic category, and it was hugely important to how society saw itself. And the Encyclopédie goes on at great length about the various different calendars, not least the classical calendars. So all these people were deeply informed by those systems. So the Roman and also Egyptian calendars are also a model for them. And as you know, the classical aesthetic, it really is adopted. David, who was also part of this committee involved in some other schemes, particularly festivals and so on, was there and others. So it really aesthetically seemed to be something to do as well, create a new classical republican calendar that was both linked to the earth and the natural world, but was also, well, it was tied to the French Revolution, the French Republic in its ultimate dating, but also could arguably be neutral and wasn't tied to Catholic or Protestant or Orthodox or Jewish or whatever. So the motivation was really to come up with a new rational system. Initial spark was a practical one, but then quickly, well,
over a few months, expanded its remit.
One of the aspects of the calendar, particularly the rural calendar that gets built out as the process goes on, is this idea of kind of drawing on classical Republican ideals and Republican virtues and using the calendar as a way to instill some of these ideas around labor, agrarian cycles and the like. Are you able to maybe just expand on a little bit about how the calendar was designed to instill what the Jacobins saw as kind of the correct values for society, but also to help promote economic growth and the like through educational means around agricultural implements and the like?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was a really important aspect of the calendar. And Gilbert Rome, who I mentioned, he was really interested in agricultural reform. He'd worked as a teacher, as a tutor, and was involved in local salons and so on. So he saw the importance of education. It went through several phases. Initially, the calendar was sort of 12 blank months. The system was there with 30 days in each month, but just numerical days. There was a sort of a blankness to it and no initial impetus to be educational in the way that it very quickly became. The committee then looks at it again. There were suggestions there might be like a month named after Montagnards and so on. And that was then deemed to be too sort of political. So look again, which is where Fabre d'Aglantine, the politician and poet and eventually seemed to be corrupt and wrapped up in various scandals and like many lost his life in the revolution, but had saw himself as a poet and so on, hence the d'Aglantine, his sort of garland awarded for his winning a literary sort of competition. Came up with this much more poetic ideas of the names of the months named after the seasons, and you have things like Germinal and Thermidor and so on. At the same time, Rome, who's really interested in agriculture, comes up with the idea of replacing the saints' days. So there is an idea that a day is not just a blank event in the year, but could be an educational moment, something to aspire to. And rather than coming up with, as Sylvain Marechal did, of a great figures to copy, he came up with this sort of idea of following the agricultural year. So it was explicitly seen as a way to teach the populace, who had already most of whom working on the land, but you know, about the potato or particular tools and so on. So if you follow the calendar throughout the year, you get crops that flower at particular points that might be the name of their day, and then you go through to winter and you learn a bit more about different soils and minerals and so on, and different agricultural implements. So you may learn something, but the very is you also celebrate something about the year. And I'm just looking over to see what the day is today. It's 1st December here. Oh, yeah, it's Day of Wax. So the start, certainly the 5th day of the week and the 10th day of the week would often be something slightly different, either a nice animal to eat or a particular implement. But we're heading into winter, so we don't have much growing. We've got a horseradish tomorrow, a cypress tree and ivy. And then Rome published a calendar for agriculture, which went 2 years, fairly well widespread in the sense you do can pick up secondhand copies, which suggests that there were various editions and you could get hold of it, where you could sort of follow the year, and each day had a sort of description of that plant and how best to care for it and how it was useful and so on. So if you followed the agricultural year, as it's quite interesting to do, you really get a sense of how it would follow. Although, of course, this really was only applicable to the Northern Hemisphere and arguably to Northern France as well. So it was quite localized and focused, despite pretensions of being universal as well.
No, as you say, it's all the various reforms that they're implementing at this time to try to create kind of standardized approaches and have a universal approach around the metric system, weights, measures, currency. As it relates to this rural calendar, the French colonies in the Caribbean and even parts of southern France are experiencing very different climates, and it's not necessarily the same time to plant a given crop on a particular day of the year. I was keen to discuss the adoption of the calendar once the National Convention decreed it in late 1793. And, you know, when we turn to its kind of practical implementation, the process was far from enlightened, I think it's fair to say. I mean, the adoption of the calendar is uneven. It's often confused. There are times that certain communities openly resist it. Are you able to outline what the adoption of the calendar looked like across France and explain why the army and the navy actually proved far more effective at embracing this new system than other parts of society.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that was something I was particularly interested in when I did my research on it, is, you know, what happened on the ground and what it so it becomes a question, I suppose, of public policy transfer, or how does one sort of impose or encourage change? And this varies throughout the revolutionary period. But if you look at the frequency of meetings and so on, which I did, and Michael Mines, a German historian, you can sort of see how people adopt to a 10-day week pattern, which was the calendar system, of course. And you see where that takes place. And there are probably no great surprises. When it's introduced, some places take it up with enthusiasm. And those tend to be places that are quite Republican. So Marseille or areas of Paris and so on. The West, which is, you know, in counter-revolution, is not a place, except, of course, the officials, where, you know, it is followed with sort of extra enthusiasm to demonstrate and adherence to the Republic. So it really sort of maps that sort of counter-revolutionary, pro-revolutionary geography of France that you see in so many other things. In particular, I suppose, the constitutional oath of the clergy and so on. There's a mapping there, which sort of maps to, I suppose, various things, you know, the way that landowning may create little communities, or a more widespread sort of peasantry who may move around and have less sense of ownership of the local areas. They may be, you know, more revolutionary, and the clergy may have a different relationship as well, maybe closer or further away to the populace and seem to be important to their needs. So you see responses to the calendar following those patterns quite clearly. Then, I suppose, in terms of the record, you get reports being sent into the centre or sent to the departmental authorities, which are being set up. And one of the things they might be concerned about is use of the calendar, and where people aren't following it, that's where you get people complaining about it, and where people are making real effort to have feast days and on the fifth or tenth day and a moment of reading out of the laws and things like that, they may try and impose that on areas which are, you know, are troublesome, so they want to make sure that they're being followed. So in some ways, you don't have many levers to pull. If you want to do this, you can teach it in schools, such as they are. That's going to take a long time. You can publish laws, but people may or may not follow them. As the Directory discovered, you can follow the Angevin regime of policing and look at fairs and markets and drinking and try and make sure that people aren't doing that on the Decadee, nor are they doing things on the former Sundays. So that leaves you, as you say, with the Navy and the Army, and they were part of the training and so on, and very quickly included in the days they set up. And so people would try and follow the calendar, and people say, okay, we're going to meet and march, whatever, on the third day of the decade or something like that, rather than on Tuesday. At least that's what they did in their official writings and so on. It's hard to know what people were sort of saying and so on. I mean, it is interesting that it's very rarely referred to in sort of private correspondence that I looked at. Occasionally people might refer to it. I remember writing to somebody else in Rennes, I think, saying, oh, it's the 1st of January or so, or the Happy New Year, as we would have once said, or maybe it's, you know, it's now the new year in the Republican calendar, as we're now supposed to say. And that's the only sort of reference to this sort of duality, this sort of fact that people were having two lives, their official lives and their more traditional one. And then the other bit, I suppose, was the Navy. We thought, we've got to convert all our logarithmic or our navigational tables to the new system. And so they started to do that, but very quickly realized it took too long, and it took a long time to be imposed, and a lot of errors introduced as well. So that wasn't a great, great success.
I did enjoy, you had a story in your book about how the army payday cycles were, of course, linked with the new system. And so, if nothing else, one of the reinforcing aspects to get the troops on board with the new calendar was that that was the calendar that was used to determine when they were next going to be paid. There was another story that you mentioned, again, with a military theme, which I really enjoyed, where you were mentioning, I believe it was in Alsace, where some local authorities were looking at the Republican calendar, and they were getting so confused by the Republican calendar that they were coming to the conclusion that this must be some sort of counter-revolutionary ploy to confuse and disrupt the defences of France. And when you had genuine misprints and misorderings of the month as you started to mass-produce this documentation, you know, it kind of lended to that
perception, which were just little stories that I really felt kind of brought to life the very human and personal implementation of the calendar. If we fast forward the clock to mid-1794 to Thermidor, and I think it's quite telling that from here on in for the next decade or so, we refer to a bunch of key events by the revolutionary calendar itself. If we look at the fall of Robespierre, the calendar in the aftermath is denounced as Jacobin excess. And yet the Thermidorians, and there we are again with references to the calendar, the Thermidorians don't abolish the calendar. And so my question is, why didn't they reverse course? And what debates took place around the calendar's future?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think partly there's just so much going on, it's hard to sort of find parliament, you know, time to change it, I suppose, is one thing. But there's still the sense, perhaps, that the calendar is a neutral thing as part of weights and measures and so on, which are also carrying on being reformed, and eventually it will sort itself out. On the other hand, you get a sense it's not enforced at all, so it's very quickly sort of forgotten or just done in an official context. So there are very quickly sort of bigger fish to fry, I suppose. But yeah, it was a moment where you could imagine it being abolished. But it also shows, I suppose, how it wasn't entirely linked to sort of the 12 that ruled, I suppose, and Robespierre and so on. It was clearly a sort of Jacobin project, but Robespierre really wasn't particularly keen on it and sort of, again, much like de-Christianization and so on, as something his particular enemies were up to and a distraction from things as well. So it was still something which could be seen as a technical, rational reform part of the new France that was being built. And in any case, they would still need this issue of when did you start the year, when do you date your laws from, and so on.
I suppose, as you say, when the revolutionaries were considering what to name the months, they explicitly rejected very political months proposals like the mountain and the like. And as you say, there would be this sense that actually this is a rational reform. It's based on nature. It's tied to the autumn equinox. There is elements here that go beyond just Jacobinism and the Montagnards. And also, I suppose there's an element that if you can repeal the calendar, if you can repeal this reform, then what else can you reverse on? And is the revolution itself something that you could backtrack on if you repeal the calendar? So that's also at play. What I find really interesting, and this goes, I think, to one of the aspects of the calendar that isn't particularly well known, is the treatment of the calendar under the Directory. And the Directory really tries to expand the use of the Republican calendar and really aggressively tries to enforce it. And so my question is, what was the Directory trying to achieve in the final years of 1790 as it enforced this, you know, kind of strict policing of Republican time? And why did it matter to them? Why, when you're at war with most of Europe, when you've got so many problems internally and on your borders as well, why were they so focused on a policing time in a Republican manner?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the thing that you would imagine focusing on, but it does tie into this sense of the Directory as it develops. You know, obviously clearly have real political difficulties, being seen as ultimately quite a corrupt elements to it, and really having to find some sort of national story to hold on to. It is at war as well, so it has to unite the nation, which is sort of putting a positive spin on it, but rather it's also a period where you really want your enemies to become apparent, and those who are opposed to the nation are useful in holding on to positions of power and so on. So there's also a big concern about public order and crime and so on. It's a period where clearly violence and disorder has broken out, and you set against the context of various things, the war going on, but also the aftermath of the terror and the whole shock of living through the revolutionary period. But the calendar is seen as something you can do in terms of helping to impose law and order. It's a way of regulating when people are on the streets and so on. And then you can also encourage a sense of national identity and adherence to the national effort by having these festivals on the 10th day and so on. And you can use it to highlight and oppose counter-revolutionaries as well. You clearly have very strong counter-revolutionary sort of battles taking place as well. So, yes, a whole host of reasons it becomes something the director gets really focused on and has some of the machinery of government to be able to try and enforce it. It has representatives and a whole systems of reporting. It has sort of the army in place. So it can make an effort to impose this, as it's also reorganizing fairs and markets and so on at the same time. So that's probably why the calendar continues. It's quite useful for these other reasons. No doubt sincerely believe in it as well, but it turned out to be a useful thing to focus on. And it really is the 18 months or so that the calendar really is imposed as much as it ever is.
Yeah, I think people would assume that it would be during the Terror that you would see the most aggressive enforcement of the Republican calendar. And yet it is several years after that that we see the Directory really enforce the calendar in a way that had not occurred in 1793-94. It's an interesting quirk, I suppose, of history. One thing that neither the Jacobins nor the Directory really tried to enforce, and they really struggled to do much with it, was this idea around decimal time. So just like the revolutionaries were adjusting weights and measurement and currency and the calendar, you had this push to decimalize hours and minutes. Why did the revolutionaries think that decimal time was desirable? And what explains why this revolutionary reform essentially failed in practice from the moment it was introduced?
Yeah, it's an interesting aspect of the calendar that they continued to not just reform the days and weeks and months, but actually the hours as well. And to decimalize the day, you have 10 hours within a day. So that might sort of fall between 5 hours of daylight and 5 hours of nighttime. Within that, you have 100, the new minutes, and then subdivided all the way down to the 100 new seconds and so on. This requires new clockwork if you want to do anything other than hours. And as soon as you're down to minutes and seconds, you need new clocks and things, which are quite complicated to do at this time. There's a sense that there may be an opportunity, a financial opportunity here, if you want to create some new factories to make these watch and clocks. But you're also going to be cutting off your export markets. So it's part of the initial reforms. There isn't much legislation to actually say that what the people had to do. This just said this is the new time. There's no, if you didn't follow it, there was no law to say that you're going to be fined or anything like that or put in prison. The Directory realizes that to introduce a new calendar, it would need some legislation. So it does have legislation around working on the decade and when fairs and markets are, and also tied into religious observance or stopping religious observance if it's not the official religion. But after Thermidor, the thing that they do say is, well, actually, we probably don't need to continue with the decimal time. There's a sense this is a step too far. It's almost like being too performatively republican or revolutionary. There are a whole bunch of schemes to come up with methods to changed clockwork and so on. Some leading clock watchmakers of the day are brought into judge competitions and so on. But with all that's going on, the fact that the clockmaking industry has been, well, more than decimated, almost suspended or wiped out because it's a luxury industry to some extent, and suddenly you have the aristocracy emigrating and so on. So it's the last thing people want to do is replace their clock and watch. You have lots of schemes to replace the clocks in the official bodies, over the town halls and the National Assembly and so on. And there's lots of discussion about how to do that and what symbolism one would include. And then I suppose you've also got hundreds of bells all over the place ringing out, and to change those is actually quite complicated. Okay, some of the bells are being melted down or hidden and so on. But it's really a big ask to change all this. There's another thing which needs to be changed as well. And there are also sundials around the place, and there are plans to do that, but nothing really happens.
Yeah, it's one of those fascinating ideas. And in some ways, decimalizing time, the idea doesn't sound that outrageous. There's maybe a parallel universe out there where we do only have 10 hours in the day or whatever it might be. But yes, it definitely didn't go far by any means. But the calendar itself actually is in effect for more than a decade. And Napoleon is the one that abolishes the revolutionary or the Republican calendar at the start of 1806. I'm curious, why did he choose to repeal the calendar? And what does his decision reveal about his political priorities and his relationship with the revolutionary past. I mean, this calendar would not have survived the Restoration in 1814, but I'm curious why Napoleon was the one to abolish it and why it was in 1806 and not earlier or potentially later.
Yeah, I guess, it highlights the way that the calendar is at once something that's practical, but yeah, hugely symbolic. You're talking about, you know, what are your origin stories and what are you saying about the most profound basis for reality and so on. A point where the calendar probably has begun to bed in to some extent. It is being followed by quite a few people in quite a few places and quite a few sort of sectors of the economy and so on. At the same time, it's clearly being completely ignored in other places and it's creeping back in. You do see it in position in the places that are becoming part of the what becomes the empire or and certainly the places that initially sort of became Republican. But again, it's something that's really only probably taken up by the administration and enthusiastic Republicans and the army. So it's really, the question is, what does it at this point bring to France? There are enough, it's causing enough friction. It's within France, but also of his external relationships. But Napoleon doesn't get rid of it straight away. It's not part of the accommodation or the, you know, the forced accommodation the Catholic Church comes to with France. It's not done when he's sort of, you know, crowned emperor, but it is palmed off to a committee, and it's very quickly, there's a sense in some of the rhetoric around it that, and Napoleon goes along with this, of course, it's the Republic, what has France has become, the nation, that isn't being rolled back. Napoleon may be at the head of it, but and it may be more and more about him and his family, but you know, France is still the glorious center of it. So the story that is telling that France rose up and sort of found itself is still sort of there within the calendar. But what they really focus on are the financial, the mercantile trade problems it causes with other countries. And in particular, the scientific issues it has. There are still one or two problems about observing the equinox in Paris. That's how the year begins. And it's one of those things that it's difficult to be completely accurate, particularly if you're doing observing. And then if you're predicting, the more scientific you get and the more detail, the level of granularity comes hard to get down to the real hundredth of a second. So there's a problem there. And there's an issue about leap years as well. What's particularly leap seconds and minutes, which they realize have to be taken into account. So there are some problems that need to be resolved. So a committee is drawn up, the sort of leading scientists to come up with what to do. They do take a while to come up with an answer. And again, it's a shame. The evidence may be there, but I haven't really found out what they were thinking. And, you know, it's kind of, you do wonder if they're trying to think, well, what's the answer we're supposed to be giving? How quickly can we do it? And they do come up with a reason to reject it, which is very practical. There is a little discussion about it, simply, no, we can still reform it and so on, but in the end it's decided, well, it's fine to let this go, and there are clearly, you know, bigger things we need to focus on at the moment. But yeah, it's interesting, it goes out, and it's clearly the system of saints' days is reintroduced once in the Restoration and so on, and then we might get on to, you know, how it is remembered and is revived at different points in France's sort of revolutionary Republican history down the line.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great segue. Are you able to just touch on that point around how the calendar is remembered and how it is revived in the 19th century?
Yeah, I mean, its afterlife is interesting. It dies off pretty quickly, which gives you a sense that maybe it after the directorial period of real focus, it wasn't really being followed that much. But then it's also a time of, you know, widespread social difficulty and chaos. So it's perhaps no surprise that it's not the main thing being followed. And then come the Restoration, it's deliberately excised and removed, and the Catholic places imposed. But there are one or two cases where people do seem to keep it going and follow it, not least, well, there are still some people who really are committed revolutionaries, and they follow it, but they're very, very rare. But you have lots and lots of reasons to have a concordance and so on. So you need to, if you're a legal agreement or a rent agreement or a loan has been begun, then you need to be able to retrospectively find out what day it was, this, you know, the second of Germinal, when you'd signed up for a loan or something, what that actually was in the new calendar. So there's a reason to keep printing the concordances. But anyway, it kind of goes away. But I think as a wider memorialization and historicization of the revolution. You have people writing memoirs, you have histories being written. So when come 1870, so this is, you know, a good time after, but you have a whole set of symbols which people can reach to. So in the Paris Commune, it is famously revived there very briefly, and clearly there are many other issues to confront whilst they were sort of in Paris being surrounded by the Prussians and so on. But it was revived then. And then you see people coming up with similar sorts of schemes to, if you want to be a revolutionary of some kind, you want to reform society, then yeah, the calendar will be part of it. And then when you get onto the Russian Revolution, one of the things they do is modernize the state and bring the calendar into line with the the Western calendar, and come up with new calendar systems as well, because they feel this is something they can do, and constantly looking back at the revolution. And I suppose you're also, we're talking about Germinal and Thermidor and the way these words are used, which wasn't really part of the original calendar in the sense it's supposed to be relatively neutral. But what you get very quickly is this sort of festive memorial calendar. And then you get the French Republic creating things in the 19th century, of things like Bastille Day and so on. So you have the whole idea you needed these national days of commemoration or festivity to inculcate Republican or national feeling and sentiment, which is something which isn't really present in the same way in the original calendar. You have a sort of a more tradition, I suppose, of days of national festival after a battle or something, and then you recreate that with local feasts and things, but they're ad hoc one-off things rather than part of an annual cycle in the same way that they become as we have today.
I wonder, just to wrap up, you've done a tremendous amount of research on the Republican calendar, and if you kind of step back from the details and look at the calendar as a broader project, you know, what do you think studying the calendar reveals about the French Revolution that we might otherwise miss when we're discussing the big ticket items and the headline grabbing events that occur in, you know, what are quite a set of tumultuous years?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what interested me was the two ends of the spectrum. You get this sort of vast transformation, big ideas and so on. You're reforming political culture, you're reforming space and time. But then it comes down to very practically about what one's wearing on your wrist and what day you're wearing Sunday best and so on. So it's about that mismatch or not. I mean, people did change and very strongly believe in these things and did things differently and were hopeful and so on, as well as terrified and bored and despairing. But you see in the everyday life what these changes mean. If you can't, I don't know, go for a drink on the 10th day or something, or you can't follow the old religious calendar that you might have been done, the sounds, the bells aren't ringing. So suddenly, oh, what do I do in turn? When do I sort of stop working or and so on? It sort of brings home the day-to-day changes. And then I suppose that the specific question, it's this sort of, how do you govern a country when you don't really have the machinery for it? You can try all these things, but ultimately they may not work. And the more you try, the more you're creating opposition or the opportunity for creating a whole series of offences that may not have been there, which feeds into the difficulty of enacting your wider political project. So yeah, so it's about the practical consequences of having big, exciting ideas. What do they mean practically? And what happens when they bump against the realities of everyday life? And everyday life, of course, being something that's not set in stone, has long traditions that feed into it, but have a whole host of different histories behind them, which can be quite sticky, and if you stir these up, then all sorts of unexpected effects, consequences happen.
I think the Republican calendar encapsulates very well a whole host of broader problems that the revolution faces, which is, as you say, how do you marry these grand idealistic visions of the new order and the way that society ought to be with the practical complications of actually realizing these visions when you're, you know, down on the high street and you're dealing with the everyday rhythms of human existence and human societies, and that misalignment there. We see it with the calendar, but there are so many revolutionary reforms that underlying theme is present there too. Matt Shaw, thank you so much for your time and joining us on Grey History. And it's been an absolute blast getting into this and all the details on this day of wax.
Thanks, William. It's been great to talk.
Thank you for listening to episode 105, The Republican Calendar. In our next main episode, we'll return to Paris in 1793 and witness Robespierre's assault against de-Christianization. In the meantime, there may be a collaboration or two that finds its way into your feed, which I know you're going to enjoy. As always, thank you so much for your support of the show. And if you'd like to learn more about Matthew Shaw's work, you can find links to his amazing publications in the show notes. I particularly enjoyed his book, Time and the French Revolution. And one last reminder that the Grey History Tour is now live. So if you want to travel with me to France in 2026, secure your ticket today. The group is strictly capped, so time is of the essence. Go to greyhistory.com/tour to secure your spot. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. Stay safe and have a great day.